Ann Wright was in the diplomatic and military corps for over 30 years. She was one of only three people to resign in protest to the war and occupation of Iraq in 2003. Since then, she has literally traveled the world, speaking about peace and social justice and the ills of society and the issues that our military are facing every day. She has this amazing book. It's both in like real book form and electronic form, called Dissent, Voice of Consciousness. If you've not read it, you really need to. This book was written in 2008, way before a lot of the NSA and Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald. Anne is a visionary. She is a true hero to many of us. And I am so honored to introduce my friend and our keynote speaker, Anne Wright.
Well, thank you very much, Pat. It's great to see you again, and it's great to be here in Chicago. And now, where are we, though? Willamette. Yeah. Well, when you're from Arkansas, growing up in Arkansas, I didn't travel much to Chicago. I'm not too familiar, although I was here last summer. I was here for a big hoop-de-doo when the G20 came right here to your fair region. And how many of you all were there? Good, yeah. That was a pretty good little dust-up as we challenged the nations of the world on some of their economic policies and military policies that they continue to need to be challenged on. I just came back from a long trip to Northeast Asia. Was there for 2.5 weeks and got back a week ago. I was there in Japan. I'd been invited to go to Japan and talk about the Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution. So here's an American going over to talk about the Japanese Constitution. A little strange, except that how many of you all know what Article 9 is? It's their no war part of their Constitution, written by the United States right after World War I, after World War II, where the Japanese people agreed with the American government, we don't want war anymore, and they wrote that Article 9, renouncing war. And unfortunately, that is under attack right now by the Abe government of Japan and by the Obama government of the United States of America. America needs some help on its wars of choice. It needs some help to pay for its wars, its military, and so they are strong-arming the Japanese to throw out that part of their Constitution. Actually, they don't quite say it that way. I mean, on October 3rd, here was the joint statement of the consultative group between the United States and Japan, and it was, you know, in diplomatic talk, it's we would like to have the government of Japan review the legal foundations for its constitution. So calling into question, should Japan continue with its self-defense force or have a military? Actually, it's about the same. It's a big military right now, but it's called self-defense, and it doesn't get involved in wars. It hasn't been at war for 68 years. And the people of Japan kind of like that. And they had asked one of us to come over to bolster their attempts at keeping that part of their constitution. I just mentioned that because it's kind of interesting, I think, to all of us to see where we end up after we leave professions. I mean, what I'm going to talk about today is about the subjects, and then they came for me. Whistleblowers in the Age of the Surveillance State. Well, I resigned from the U.S. government 10 years ago. I resigned in March of 2003 in opposition to the Bush war on Iraq. I was one of three. Thank you. I was one of three government employees, federal government employees, that resigned. It turned out we all were from the State Department. We were all diplomats. Brady Kiesling was our political counselor in our U.S. Embassy in Athens, Greece. John Brown was on a special assignment at Georgetown University, and then I was the deputy chief of mission, or deputy ambassador, out in Mongolia. Well, you probably say, well, she was exiled out to Mongolia. Well, I guess in a way I do self-exiles, because my whole diplomatic career was in places of sometimes crisis, but certainly of interest. I started out with the State Department in Nicaragua, with the U.S. Embassy in Nicaragua, and then the U.S. Embassy in Grenada. I was in Somalia, both with the U.S. liaison mission there and the United Nations. Then I helped reopen the U.S. Embassy in Uzbekistan, then was in Kyrgyzstan. I was in Sierra Leone during the civil war there, where we had to evacuate 2,500 people from that civil war. Then in Micronesia, out in the middle of the Pacific. Then I helped reopen the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan in December of 2001 and stayed there for 5 months. Then going on to what became my last assignment as the Deputy Chief of Mission of the U.S. Embassy in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. And it was there that I could not go along with a policy of the United States. I mean, I had been in the U.S. government for 35 years, 8 different presidents I'd served under, starting with Lyndon Johnson back during the Vietnam War. That's when I joined the military. I'd stayed in the military either on active duty or in the reserves for 29 years. The issue of resignation from a government that you'd spend most of your life in, of holding your nose to some policies that you didn't agree with, because most government employees don't agree with everything that the crazy administrations that we, the people of the United States, elect. And we've elected some doozies on all sides of it. How many of you all have ever been a government employee? Yeah, several. Uh-huh. Yeah, and I would suspect if we had asked each one of these people that they would say, no, are you crazy? I didn't agree with all the things that were going on. But it's a real challenge, you know, to, in your own conscience, to determine when or not you're going to speak up, when you really think something's going wrong, or when you should be quiet, not rock the boat. And I think I was quiet on some things that I probably should have been speaking up on. I spoke up on some things, both in the military and in the State Department, on policies that I felt needed to have a better hearing. Even on this Iraq war, I sent in a dissent cable to the State Department saying why I was so concerned that it looked like the United States was going to invade and then occupy this Arab, oil-rich, Muslim country that had not attacked the United States and had nothing to do with 9/11. And this issue of weapons of mass destruction, even though my boss, Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, had given that impassioned plea to the UN Security Council in February of 2003 to convince the UN Security Council to vote for military operations in Iraq. The weapons of mass destruction, and you remember that, don't you? I mean, you remember vividly that. Well, I'll just digress for it a little bit. Earlier this week, I was in Arkansas. I spoke 3 places in Arkansas, including 2 universities, and I asked that same question. You all remember that day in February when Colin Powell gave that impassioned plea to the UN Security Council, and there was you could just see the blank look on these students' faces, and it was like, oh my God, yes, that's right. That was 10 years ago. And so how old were you when that happened? Oh, I was 8. I was 9. And I said, well, have any of you watched this on TV? It's on YouTube. And not a one of them in this university auditorium had ever watched what we saw as the basis for which the United States went into an 8-year war where hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have been killed, and the killing goes on every single day now as hundreds of people are being killed every single month in sectarian violence that has been precipitated by the war the United States had on Iraq. Well, I saw that presentation that Colin Powell did. I was in Mongolia. I watched it on TV, and I wasn't convinced with his presentation, nor was the UN Security Council, because they voted not to authorize military operations in Iraq, and yet the Coalition of the Willing went ahead without UN government, UN authorization. Well, for me, who had been in the government for so long, it was a real dilemma. I mean, I enjoyed my career in the State Department, and on one level, I didn't want to give it up, but on another level, I couldn't figure out how in the world one could rationalize staying in if you had such concerns about this policy. And so, at long last, I decided that I would go ahead and resign. And as I mentioned, there were only three of us that resigned. In contrast to what happened in England, in the UK, where Tony Blair's government had joined with George Bush's and had become a part of the Coalition of the Willing. In that government, much smaller than the U.S. government, 15 people, five times more people resigned than did in the U.S. government. Resignation is not one of the great hallowed traditions that we have in the United States. It really isn't. We don't teach our young people to resign on principle. We don't teach our young people to really think carefully about where they're working, about what's going on with that organization, whether it is in government, whether it's in big business and what those big businesses do, whether they make weapons, whether they are security organizations for corporations or for governments. You know, the moral and ethical view of how we look at our own lives, I think we need to really reconsider. We really do need to teach these things in our schools. We need to talk about them. And yet you see in most high schools, they don't even have a civics class anymore. The teaching of American history, world history, these types of educational opportunities we have for young kids and older kids are going by the by. And yet we face such moral dilemmas right now. We face a predicament with whistleblowers. I mean, we want to know what our government's doing. I would think, don't you all want to know? Yeah, we want to know what's going on. Certainly, there are parts of our government operations that I, as a, having had a security clearance for like 35 years, I mean, I do know that there are some things that I don't think probably we all need to know right at any one moment, that there are probably some negotiations behind the scenes that it's probably better that we don't know about until things kind of move along on them. So I fully appreciate the fact that there are classified events or documents, but I really do appreciate the fact that Private Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, looked into the documents that she had access to as a little private out in Iraq and saw some dealings that the U.S. government was doing with other countries, some things that our own U.S. military was doing that she saw, that she felt the American public needed to see, that they were identifying things that our government was doing that were wrong and that we, the people of the United States, needed to know about. Never in my life have I read so many diplomatic cables than through WikiLeaks. As a diplomat for 16 years, I can guarantee you, I never saw the numbers of diplomatic cables because they're all, or most of them are kind of compartmentalized. You get the ones for your region, but you don't get the worldwide access to everything that's being written. Well, the value of this whistleblowing is quite remarkable now. You know, I mentioned that I just come from a trip around Northeast Asia. Well, in every place we went, whether it's Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, China, we ran into people who were talking about the revelations that came about their government's contact with the United States government. That indeed, in many countries throughout the world, there have been enormous amounts of materials that have been given to the people of those countries by their media using the WikiLeaks documents. I mean, a question to you all. How many of you all have really ever read any of the WikiLeaks diplomatic cables? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So most of us have not. But if you go to other parts of the world, for example, Spain, I was there 2 weeks after the WikiLeaks were exposed, that they started be printing, that they were given to El País, one of the national newspapers of Spain. And for the following 6 weeks, every single day, there was a four-page supplement in El País, which put out all of the diplomatic cables. The people of Spain knew what was going on, and they appreciated the fact that they now had a clue of some of the things that were happening behind the scenes. It was really important, I think, if it is important now for history. If you look in most books on national security issues, if you go first to the index and look for W's, it will be a rare book these days that will not reference WikiLeaks and have some of the documents that are very important to national security issues that are being listed in that book. What happened to the whistleblower Bradley Manning? Well, you probably over the last 2.5, 3 years, you've known that he's been detained first before you get convicted. He was detained for 2 years before a court-martial. The court-martial happened this summer. He was convicted, 35 years in jail for disclosure of classified information. There are a lot of people who say that we needed to have that information. There are a lot of people also who say, well, he got what he deserved, that he needs to be punished for disclosing what he did. He needs to be in jail for disclosing what's now known as the collateral murder video, the murder that shows that the United States Apache helicopter that has already shot up several people in the streets of Baghdad and is now hovering above a street, and there is a guy crawling along that's already been wounded, crawling along the street, and then a van pulls up, and a van that you can see in the front from the helicopter, you can see that there are two little kids sitting in the front of that van, and then the van door opens, and two guys get out to go over to reach for the fellow that's on the ground, and then in the background you hear the helicopter pilot voices that are saying, he's crawling, he's going to get away. We want permission to fire. And then permission is given, and the scene is just blown up. The helicopter pilots fire the rockets that they have and blow up the van. Have you seen that one? Have you seen that? It's called collateral murder. And that's what Bradley Manning saw, that indeed what had happened was that the people that were in the van were Reuters news reporters who had gone out looking for one of their crew who had gone missing, and they were the ones in the van. And Reuters had been asking for years to the Department of Defense, do you have any video, any footage of what happened to our reporters? We want to know what happened. How did they get killed this way? And the Department of Defense had maintained, no, we don't have that. We don't have it. And Bradley Manning saw, yes, we do have it. I saw it. I found it in all of the archives that I had access to. And that was one of the reasons that he felt he needed to expose that to the world, that it was wrong what the helicopter pilots had done. That indeed the lack of information, the lack of intelligence on that operation really had caused a horrific scene, a horrific tragic incident, and it should not be repeated, and the only way to not repeat it is to learn from it and perhaps people be disciplined for that. Well, Bradley Manning then started looking for other things and ultimately disclosed that huge volume of information. Then other information that had been disclosed earlier, though, that we put in the book that Pat mentioned, Dissent Voices of Conscience, and it leads to another part of what people are concerned about in our country, the indefinite detention and imprisonment of people that are in Guantanamo, the torture that had got them there, the kidnapping and the extraordinary rendition that means that over 779 people have been imprisoned in Guantanamo over the 12 years now that prison has been in operation. Do you know how many people are left in Guantanamo right now? 164. How many of that 164 have already been cleared for release? In fact, several years ago, cleared for release, half of them. 84 of those people have been cleared for release. And yet they're still there. Our latest president, who came in on a campaign promise of closing Guantanamo, has not been able to fulfill that, has not fulfilled it. 80 people, of whom 45, even this administration says, we cannot ever put them on trial, because we've done things to them that we cannot acknowledge, we cannot admit. We can't put them on trial. And this is in the land of justice. This is in the land of the rule of law. This is in the land of human rights for all. And yet what we have done in the name of war, in the name of going after terrorists, is that we can no longer put on trial people because we've tortured them so badly. And it brings up, how did we even know who was in Guantanamo? You know, if you think back in 2003 and 2004, the United States had acknowledged, yes, we do have people in Guantanamo. We've put people in there. First, they gave out the number. And then after much media pressure and the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU filing lawsuits against the government for not releasing any more information about who was there. Finally, the countries from where people were acknowledged. But, you know, as lawyers all over the country started volunteering to be the defense attorneys for these people in Guantanamo, to say that they deserve a defense, we need to have someone there to challenge what the government is saying they did. How can we even have defenders for them when we don't even know their names? Well, a whistleblower, a Navy commander, who was an attorney down in Guantanamo, a Navy JAG officer, saw the idiocy of this whole thing and said, there's no way that we can continue this facade that we've got going on in Guantanamo. The names of those prisoners must be revealed. And Lieutenant Commander Matthew Diaz copied the names of the people in Guantanamo and the countries of origin and sent that on a CD to the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, where it was placed in the public domain. Well, what do you think happened to Lieutenant Commander Matthew Diaz, 16 years in the Navy, a Navy lawyer? What do you think Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, had to say about that? Ooh, not good, not good. Ultimately, it came out that it was Matthew Diaz that had revealed those names. He was court-martialed. He was found guilty of giving out classified information, the names of the prisoners in Guantanamo. And he was sentenced to 6 months in prison and given a dishonorable discharge. He was a whistleblower. How did we ever find out what was going on in Abu Ghraib? You know, the prison in Iraq in 2004. And you remember those horrific, horrific, horrific pictures of what our U.S. military, our military police were doing in the wings of Abu Ghraib, the piles of prisoners, naked prisoners, being paraded around by people, stacking them up in a pyramid. Well, the reason that came to light was because of another whistleblower, a young man by the name of Joe Darby. He was a specialist in the U.S. Army. He was assigned to that same military police unit that was doing all these bad things, but he was on the admin side of it. He really didn't go down into the wings of Abu Ghraib to see on a nightly basis to see what was going on. He was up in the headquarters. Well, one day one of the sergeants from down on the wings came up. His name was Sergeant Fredericks, and said, "Hey, Darby, you want to see what we do on a Saturday night down in the prison? Here, take a look at this," and gave him a CD of photos. And Darby looked at it and went, "Oh my God, I mean, this is horrible. We don't do those things. We're not supposed to do that. We're taught not to mistreat prisoners. And look what's happening. Well, what do you do when you know your own unit is a part of this?" Well, Joe Darby thought long and hard about it, and his conscience got the better of him. And he went to the Criminal Investigative Division, the office of his battalion that investigates potential crimes, and gave him that CD. And then the investigation moved ahead. It was leaked to 60 Minutes. 60 Minutes was going to air these photographs. And that precipitated Donald Rumsfeld again coming forward on international television to talk about what was happening, that a few bad apples were spoiling the barrel in Abu Ghraib, and that I can remember this too. I remember seeing this, that, you know, here was Donald Rumsfeld up there, and you can imagine, you know, Donald Rumsfeld, yeah, a few bad apples there, but essentially everything's going okay. We can still do that mission, lean and mean. We don't need many people down there. Those pictures are pretty bad, but we're getting through it, and we have to thank for this Joe Darby, Specialist Joe Darby, for bringing it to our attention. Well, Joe Darby just happened to be sitting in the cafeteria at the Abu Ghraib prison, sitting on a table with some of the people who had been doing these terrible things to the prisoners. And when Donald Rumsfeld said, "It's Joe Darby that's told on you," the whole table looked at Darby, "You rat, you whatever." Well, Joe Darby knew he was at the end of his line. He went to his company commander and said, "I think I'm in big trouble. I request to be immediately reassigned." And the company commander, to his credit, I mean, it was his whole unit that was in trouble, but he knew that if anything happened to Joe Darby, that he would be in bigger trouble. They sent Joe Darby back to the United States. Joe Darby went into a witness protection program for the military and then into the federal witness protection program, where he is still today. Because his family in West Virginia was already getting threat messages from the families of the other people that were now under investigation. So the life of a whistleblower is not an easy life. The life of Bradley Manning in jail, the life of Julian Assange, who is one of the people that runs the WikiLeaks, who's now in his own prison of sorts at the Ecuador Embassy in London and has been there for over a year. And prior to that was in a much better living arrangement, actually, outside of London. But Julian Assange will be in that embassy until the United States decides it will not prosecute him if they catch him. A secret indictment that is in the federal court system in Alexandria, Virginia, is purported to be ready any time Julian Assange comes out of that embassy. And then you look at a little bit further to the east in Europe, where Ed Snowden is now in Russia. Ed Snowden, who has revealed some remarkable things about the National Security Agency. You know, he wasn't the first person to be talking about misdeeds of the NSA. Back in 2005, a man named Ed Tice, who worked for the NSA, got in big trouble when he revealed to the world that there were switching boxes in AT&T's major switching, whatever they call them, big rooms in special areas where the connections between AT&T in this direction, going to that direction, there were little switching boxes that belonged to the government, and that the government was listening in on some of those conversations. Little did we know in 2005, when Ed Tice had to fight for his life in a federal court, that indeed 8 years later in 2013, we would be facing the revelations of the extent to which we know at this point that the United States is eavesdropping on not only people around the world, which has been happening over the centuries, to a small scale, it's been happening in history, small in comparison to what we now know is going on, where in one day, now it's reported that in Spain, over 60 million phone calls were tapped into by the NSA. And now that we know that 35 leaders of other nations have had their personal cell phones and their email accounts being tapped into for many, many years. Well, it is causing a problem. I mean, knowing these things, it is a problem. And our government is very, very embarrassed that these secrets have been found out. And they are mad that we know what they're doing. Our Congress, who is supposed to have some sort of oversight on intelligence and some sort of oversight of the NSA, if they've been oversighting and they've known all of this all along, I am filled with horror and dismay that they, our elected officials, have been saying we, the people of the United States, should have this sort of surveillance on us. I mean, what is becoming of our country, the surveillance state, in this era is scary. It is really, really scary. It harkens back, of course, to the George Orwell specter of 1984 with Big Brother all over us. Big Brother knowing everything we do. Big Brother being able to know that you all now are now in the room with Anne Wright because my cell phone is giving it away and your cell phones are giving it away. That they know that you're right here. You're right here listening to speech. Listening to speech that is challenging policies of the United States of America. Policies that I believe need to be challenged, and I'm willing to speak up on them. But policies that our government may at any time say, those policies are fine, and anyone that challenges them should be prosecuted. I mean, if you look what happened to Glenn Greenwald's partner as he came out of Berlin and then into London, and they took his computers, and on the computers were things that the British government definitely wanted to see, of things coming from Ed Snowden. I still can't figure out why in the world they did that, that the partner David was carrying those computers. But the bottom line is now the British government is saying that just carrying those types of materials, that is a terrorist act. So we live in a time where whistleblowers are getting fewer and fewer on one level. I mean, you'd think they would. We've had six people who have been classified as whistleblowers who are now charged with espionage. Two of them, the cases have already been dismissed, the espionage cases, because it's so outrageous what they did to be classified as terrorist acts. You have Tom Drake, an NSA, a senior executive service NSA, worked for the government 30 years. He saw that the NSA was purchasing a computer program that would not work, and they were paying billions of dollars for it, and Tom said, it's not working, it cannot, you don't pay him $2 billion for this, and he kept going through the system, nobody would listen to him, and he went outside the system. And by going outside that system, he was charged with espionage for revealing some of the programs that NSA uses, even if they don't work. And it was only at the last minute that the federal case folded, because finally a judge said, this is outrageous. What you, the government, have done to this man and what you're trying to do is wrong. And ultimately, he pled guilty to having one set of information, was given a slap on the wrist, and he's out. He did not go to jail. However, right now, Tom Drake can only get a job as a clerk at the Apple store in Washington, D.C. The government is going to make sure he does not work in any sort of meaningful, responsible job ever again. What we're facing is really, really a disaster for our country, for the constitutional protections that we have prided ourselves for so long. But as we find out more and more and more of these things that our government's doing, it gives us the opportunity to push back, against them, to support people who, at great risk of their own personal freedom, let us know what's going on. It's because of good people like you all that an extraordinary amount of money was raised to help for the defense of Chelsea Manning, where she had a very, very good lawyer who was able to get the prison time that she is serving down from 120 years to 35 years. Ed Snowden right now has no support system like that. WikiLeaks, in its own way, is trying to support him, but right now there's no national group here in the United States that's trying to do fundraising for Ed Snowden. Of course, he's not in front of a court. He does not yet need a defense attorney. But should that time come, I hope that you all will consider what he has done to help us understand what our government is doing and help us provide those protections. The Government Accountability Project, called GAP, in Washington, D.C., does a tremendous job with men and women who are in our government who are letting us know what's happening. So I would appreciate it very much if you would consider any sort of donation to the Government Accountability Project. Because as it says on our program, and then they came for me, whistleblowers in the age of the surveillance state, you never know what may happen. So let's all stand behind whistleblowers, let's give great support to them, and let's make sure that our government is pushed back from this disastrous road of the invasion of privacy and the curtailment of our own civil liberties. Thank you very much. What's going on? Well, I travel with everybody. The trip to Asia, I was by myself. I joined up with a group, though, that's called the Peace Boat, and I'll just give a little plug for that. How about a boat for peace? A boat for peace in the world? How about a 1,000-passenger ship that travels around the world, picking up people in one place, giving them all sorts of information about the next place they're going, lets them off at that place, and let them see and talk to people. A peace boat. I was on the peace boat that's run by the Japanese, a Japanese NGO, and on the trip that I was in Northeast Asia, we had 500 Japanese and 500 South Koreans, and they were there on a voyage of friendship because of the problems that are going on now in Japan because of the hate speech and hate actions against the Koreans. So this is a great opportunity. They go on three-month cruises around the world. Not that most people can get off for 3 months in a row, but a lot of retired Japanese are going on that thing. 1,000 people. So that's where I was this last time. I do a lot of traveling with Veterans for Peace and Code Pink Women for Peace. In fact, Code Pink Women for Peace and I were, at this time last year, we were in Pakistan. To talk with victims of American drone attacks in Pakistan. In May of this year, we were in Yemen talking with victims, families of victims of drone attacks in Yemen, and also with families of prisoners that are in Guantanamo who have been cleared for release. So those are the two main groups that I usually travel with. Well, certainly the Patriot Act, in my opinion, is an unnecessary curtailment of the civil liberties of Americans. It has a real impact on what federal agencies are able to do to us. And I think it should be definitely relooked and cut out, most of it. The Justice Department is the one that prosecutes these cases, the U.S. Justice Department. And it is it's very startling, in my opinion, to see the fact that whistleblowers who should be given federal protection, but one of the exemptions in federal protection for whistleblowers is if they blow the whistle on national security affairs. Well, you'd think that's the one you'd want to have protection for, because these are the things that really, really are the serious things for our own personal security as well as our national security. But it is the Justice Department that does prosecute them. Well, thank you very much. That's an excellent point of talking about here in Chicago the groups of Arab, Muslim, Palestinians who are bearing the brunt of really the war on terror as it's investigated here in the United States. It is pretty startling when you get the statistics on the numbers of Muslim and Arab Americans who have been detained, investigated, and the numbers of people who are being put in jail as a part of the material aid to terrorist acts, material aid which can be virtually anything. It can be giving money to charities that later on the United States government says this is a group that supports terrorist activities. When you give it to them, there had been no designation by the United States that organization was such. But later on it is, and then they backdate that investigation to you and the fact that now you have contributed to a terrorist organization in their opinion. And then when you look at some of the organizations that the U.S. government has designated as terrorist organizations, well, it's a politically expedient thing. You know, some terrorist organizations suddenly become not so terrorist anymore. I mean, if you look at the Libyan government, that was a terrorist organization for the longest time, and then it became not one. Then it became the target of a NATO attack. There are groups that the United States, for political expedient purposes, will classify as a terrorist organization, and people go to jail for supporting it. And when you really dig into what the organization is about, I have real questions about why some of these organizations have been designated as such. And I think in Chicago, you've got a lot of examples of people that have been wrapped up wrongly for any sort of criminal actions. The question is, what are the statistics on sexual assault in the military? Well, I spent 29 years of my life in the U.S. military, 16 on active duty and 13 on active duty, 16 in the reserves. And now knowing the statistics, I feel really lucky that I was not a victim of sexual assault or rape in the military. 1 in 3 women are raped or sexually assaulted while they're in the military. And this is in a very compressed period of time. From 4 to 6 years is what most women spend in the U.S. military. 1 in 3. The United States military now is estimating that in any 1 year, at least 29,000 people in our military are sexually assaulted by other people in our military, to include men. The incident of sexual assault on men in the military is something that we're just now seeing. We're seeing the tip of the iceberg on this one. 10% of the people who reported being sexually assaulted or raped in the military last year were men. And if you think it's difficult enough for a woman to come forward to say to the company commander, somebody sexually assaulted me. If you think it's hard enough for a woman to come forward, think how difficult it is for a guy to come forward to say, somebody jumped me in the shower, somebody blanket party in the barracks. You know, and all of this is, it's not homosexual rape at all. It's power. Power assault on another person. So some people say, well, do you recommend for young men and women to go in the military now? And this is a difficult one for me because I feel I got quite a bit out of my time in the military. I got education. I got, you know, the things that they recruit you on. But I'll tell you right now, the incidence of sexual assault on women and men in the military is something that I would be very, very careful about in recommending to any young person to go in. Right now at the Naval Academy, the military academies are some of the worst. And here you're bringing young people out of communities from all over the country. They come to a military academy, and in a very short period of time, they go into a culture where it seems to be okay to sexually assault other people. So our military has a big problem on its hands because of some U.S. Congress women who have started really speaking up about this. At least the senior leadership of our military is acknowledging that there is a big problem. But so far, they have not instituted the procedures that will probably be the ones that will bring this to a close. And that would be that the senior leadership in those units where this stuff is occurring, that those senior leaders are also punished for creating an atmosphere in that unit where somebody thinks they can get away with sexually assaulting another person. The question is, would I agree with the United States continuing to be a part of an alliance for the defense of Japan if the Japanese would continue to pay for it? I believe that's kind of the crust of it. They pay for it right now. I mean, the Japanese government pays big time for the United States to defend them. They pick up all the costs of the United States military being in Japan, the 68 years that millions of Americans have been assigned in Japan. The Japanese government pays for the maintenance of the bases. The Japanese government will be paying for the removal of U.S. military from Okinawa, where 75% of the military bases in Japan are located on the island of Okinawa, which is only 2% of the land base of Japan. And the people of Okinawa are tired of the U.S. military presence and tired of young women being raped by U.S. military there. Some of the strongest protests, citizen protests against U.S. military bases worldwide has been in Okinawa. To the extent that the U.S. government has said that it will remove 10,000 U.S. military from Okinawa by the early 2020s, and they intend to move them to Guam or Hawaii. The people in Guam say, no, wait a minute, we are a small island also. If you bring 10,000 military plus their dependents plus contractors, you will increase the population of our little island by 25%, and we can't handle it. The governor of the state of Hawaii, where I actually live right now, has said, bring them all back to Hawaii. We've got enough space on the island of Oahu to take care of all of them. The Japanese government does pay. It pays big time for anything that happens militarily that the U.S. does in Japan. And in fact, for the movement of the 10,000 Marines out of Okinawa to Guam, the budget for that is enormous. And the Japanese government is going to be paying that. They are disputing part of it because the U.S. government is kind of charging a little bit more than the Japanese want for some of these things. The U.S. government is saying to the Japanese government it will cost at least $800,000 to build a home for a military family in Guam, and we want you to pay that for those 10,000 Marines that are going in there. And the government of Japan says, now wait a minute, we are building some homes for our people that are the victims of the Fukushima tsunami, earthquake, radioactivity thing. We are paying $200,000 for that. So why should we be paying four times as much for your houses? So the bottom line on this whole thing is that the Japanese government pays a lot of money right now to be in this alliance with the United States. It's a good question on what is the rationale that the U.S. government is using on prosecuting so many people right now as whistleblowers, and is this kind of what was going on before, we just didn't know about it? Well, one of the things is, I think because we've had such a change in how our government operates over the last 12 years, since 9/11, that the United States government has been involved in what I believe are illegal and criminal acts committed by our government in kidnapping people, moving them around the world to secret prisons, torturing them, and those types of acts are things the U.S. government has consistently not wanted to be too much in the public domain. And when that veil of secrecy is lifted off of it, the government gets embarrassed. The government tries to protect its actions by going back to Congress to getting like a backdated check on this thing, where we have the administration that calls torture enhanced interrogation techniques. And where you now have, you know, the Vice President of the United States, former Vice President Dick Cheney, who is readily admitting on television of going to the dark side, that yes, these enhanced interrogation techniques that have brought people to the point of organ failure, this was all right. It was good for the U.S. national security. These types of things, I think the administrations don't want us to know what's going on. And when somebody does come forward with some information on things that they don't want us to know, whether it's just for embarrassment or where it may identify criminal acts being committed by people in our government, they don't like that. And historically, I suspect that's probably true all the way along, that when anybody has come forward with information about the government, that the effort to silence them has been very, very strong. Well, the question, and I'm repeating it so that we can get it on the video here, is are there win-win situations when the government can feel that by changing and accommodating the comments, the concerns about from citizens, when will that happen? Or could that happen? I guess that's more... Could it happen? Well, that's really the intent of whistleblowers. I mean, they're hoping that the government will see the merit of the issue that they're bringing forward. In fact, most of these whistleblowers try to work within the system first and then are shut down by the system and then feel they have to go outside the system. And then when they go outside, then the government or the system or the corporation really is angry and takes after them. And your point of us being in the survival mode is really true. And a lot of people say it's done for a purpose. It's done for a purpose to kind of keep the people quiet, that put them under economic stress, put them under security stress, put them under surveillance, keep them quiet. I mean, if you look at what happened to the Occupy movement 2 years ago, here was probably the biggest demonstration since the big marches that we had before the Iraq War. Communities all over this country, I think there were something like 1,500 Occupy groups sprang up. And I don't know how many of you all were a part of the one in the Chicago area, or many of them in the Chicago area. But it was a powerful, powerful time. I mean, people were really challenging a lot of the issues that we're dealing with, and they were trying to creatively figure out how to get around the fact that so many people were going into bankruptcy because of these terrible mortgages that people had signed on to, and the variety of issues. And yet, what happened to most of them? I went to 35 Occupies during that fall, and most of them were violently torn up by the police, violently torn down. People were beaten up and thrown in jail. And it shows, in my opinion, that the government was very concerned, that we had people that were on the streets or in the tents or sitting around talking, just talking about how to better our society, and yet that was a threat. And if you look at the people in the State Department that were there when the three of us resigned, each one of us got hundreds of emails from colleagues that were assigned to embassies all over the world saying, you're doing the right thing. This decision of the administration to invade and occupy Iraq is going to be a disaster for, of course, the Iraqis. There will be thousands of Iraqis that will be killed by this military operation, and there are going to be thousands of Americans killed. And we wish we could resign with you, but we've got kids in colleges, we've got mortgages, we've got, you know, the economic problems that you mentioned, that if we join you in resignation, how will we make a living? How will we make a living? And that in itself has really did silence a lot of the dissent that was in the State Department about this decision to go to war in Iraq. Well, the question is, how helpful is the press in helping illuminate the rest of the country that there has been a whistleblower, and what the issue the whistleblower is bringing up? In general, unless it's a big case like Ed Snowden, we get very little attention to the whistleblowers until the case goes to trial, and usually it's at the very end of the trial for the verdict of it. Even for Chelsea Manning, where the pretrial hearings, which were about 18 of them, prior to the court-martial, we seldom had any reporter that would cover the pretrial hearings, and yet that was really where the decisions were being made by the court-martial authority on what was going to be allowed in court. Even during the, 20-day court-martial, it wasn't until the very end that there were, the very beginning and the very end, that there was a lot of media attention. The media should be the help on this to at least illuminate the American public of what's going on, but tragically I feel it's failing us in that. Democracy Now, of course, is an exception to that, and the Pacifica radio networks, and probably you've got a good progressive station here in Chicago. There are little beacons of light out there, but the general mainstream media is not particularly helpful. Well, the question is on the issue of drones, and finally getting families of drone victims to come to the United States to testify before the U.S. Congress as to what happened and what the blowback is from those drone strikes. It actually was not the family of Malala who was shot in the face. It was a different family. The family lives out in the in Waziristan, and as did Malala. But this family, three people, the father and two of the children, came to tell the U.S. Congress that about their grandmother and other members of their family that were out in an agricultural field that were blown up by a U.S. drone. The lawyer who was to be coming with them, a man by the name of Shahzad Akbar, who is a lawyer who has actually sued the United States of America in Pakistan for his drone strikes, and whom set up the visit that we made last year in Pakistan, and who came to our first international drone conference that was held in the fall of last year, and who has worked for USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development. He's been a U.S. government employee in years past. He was not granted a visa to come to the United States to accompany this family. It was not a congressional hearing. The Republican leadership of the committee would not allow a congressional hearing. It was held as a briefing, a congressional briefing, and as you mentioned, it was to the shame of our U.S. Congress that only five congressional members came to that briefing. It was horrible, horrible. But that family has talked on Democracy Now! And talked to other media, and we do know, because of the stink that's been caused about why didn't congressmen and women go to that, the issue of speaking to drone victims has gotten a higher profile. We are trying to bring other people from Yemen and from Pakistan to the second annual International Drone Conference, which will be held in 2 weeks in Washington, D.C. And it's not too late to register for that. It's going to be an excellent, excellent conference where we are keeping our fingers crossed as we are typing out our emails to the State Department saying, please grant these visas, and making phone calls to the State Department and to congressional delegations to put pressure on the State Department to let these people who have suffered, whose family members have been killed by U.S. drones. You know, there have been four Americans that have been killed by U.S. drones, three of them in the last 2 years. So it's not that Americans are getting off free. Americans are being identified by the President of the United States on Terror Tuesday when he gets a list from the U.S. 16 intelligence agencies of the United States of those people our intelligence agencies feel have done something against the U.S. interest to the extent that they should be executed. And our president becomes the chief prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner, which to me is just a horrific thing that this has devolved into, where a constitutional lawyer from right here in Hawaii and Illinois now feels that he has the authority that he, as commander-in-chief, I mean, that's what he'll say, commander-in-chief, that he has the authority to execute people. We don't know on what legal basis other than this commander-in-chief thing, because the administration wants to keep secret, silent, all of those legal memorandum that have been created, just like under the Bush administration, the creation of the legal memorandum that will protect the president from potential war crime allegations. So this issue of drones is a really big one right now. It kind of brings to a head a lot of the concerns that we have about governmental policies. And with that, I will thank you all. Thank you for bringing that up. It's quite remarkable. You know, the drone industry is one of the biggest industries going now. It's really where all the action is, as well as in the military. We train more drone pilots in the U.S. Air Force than we do fixed-wing pilots for our Air Force. We use that many drones. And the drone industries, of which there are now like 900 of them in the United States, want to get these things in commercial use, because the military is just one part of it. There need to be drones everywhere. And so the drone lobby, of which there is a congressional caucus, a drone caucus that our congressmen and women are in, have passed a law saying that by the year 2016, the FAA has to have completed the procedures for figuring out how 30,000 drones can be integrated into U.S. commercial airspace in 1 year. 30,000 drones that are going to be flying alongside of your commercial aircraft. 30,000 drones that, well, we don't know anything about the training of drone operators. We don't know the reliability of the types of drones. There's so much that's going to have to happen in this period, and the designated of 6 areas in the United States where the testing will come about, I would just like to say, I hope I don't live in one of them. Thank you.